I'd like to bring up our Sergeant of Arms, Mike Kay, to introduce our guest speaker.
Hi. My name is Mike Kenyon. I'm an alcoholic. And it's by God's grace and the actions of Alcoholics Anonymous and sponsorship. I've not had a drink since March 20th of 1994. For that, I'm very grateful. I claim no credit. I'm very glad to be here this evening. Glad to be sober. And it's my pleasure and my privilege to be a member of this group and to be invited to host and introduce our speaker this evening. And, oops, did you get that? I don't know our speaker sponsor. I don't know our speaker's home group. But our speaker does come highly recommended. In fact, he's my grand sponsor's, or one of my grand sponsor's most favorite members of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I asked Scott, you know, what he'd like me to say about him from the podium this evening. And I'm going to paraphrase. And basically he said that he hopes you enjoy his talk, and I'm certain that you will. And with that, would you please help me welcome warmly from Los Angeles, California, Scott Art. Thank you.
My name's Scott Redmond. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Scott.
I haven't had a drink since April 22nd, 1985, and it ain't my fault. Thank you so much. Yeah. Michael, you are so diplomatic. That was just... Thank you so much for having me as your guest tonight. I can't tell you how much I appreciate it. I've just had a great evening. And heard my friend Ava give a great talk, and one of my dear, dear friends, one of my sponsees, who I just... love is here tonight, and this is just a great group. I've been greeted and treated very, it's just wonderful. I'm having a great time, and it's been a challenging day, but a great night. When I was a kid, I was abusive to animals. I was abusive to family pets, and this was a big deal on my inventory. I was so ashamed of it, so horrified by my behavior. I had a bunch of inventory about it, and it came out in my inventory, and there were a lot of resentments against myself, and it came out that I was scared of animals, in addition to everything else. And when I said, Father, please remove this to when I did 6 and 7, and I said, Father, please remove this terrible fear of animals, turn my attention to what you would have me be. In other words, what you want. My plan is to be scared of animals. That's the Scott Redmond program. Then I'm going to ask God, what would you rather me do instead of being scared of animals? And sometimes at meetings you hear a lot of people talk about walking through the fear, which is a great thing, but sometimes God doesn't say walk through the fear. He says walk away from the fear. He walk around the fear. He doesn't say go pet a puppy, necessarily. You know, and the voice said, stay the hell away from animals. So I stayed the hell away from animals. And around 10 years of sobriety, I was at an AA conference, and this gorgeous little puppy ran into me, up to me, and I realized I was free. I didn't have to be scared. I was free of it. And for the last, I'm 19 and a half years sober, 19 in about 9 months, but who's counting? And and I'm free of this. And right before I left Los Angeles, I had some dental work done. I know this is unusual for an alcoholic, but dentistry was not really high on my list of anything. I remember in sobriety, I sold a gold tooth. Not in sobriety, before. That was not a good day at all. Especially because when I put the tooth down, the guy like put a glove to pick my tooth up. At any rate, I have like these bridges in the back of my mouth. And they got removed right before I left here, so I got like 4 teeth. So I'm eating like a rat, basically. And I'm getting on the plane, and the dentist dummies up a bridge, which is my only shot at like eating like, you know, a member of this species while I'm in New York. So my friend offers me his apartment while I'm in the city. I'm going to be in the city all week. And he says, you know, I just got a cat. What? What? It's be an interesting kind of thing. Her name's Grace, you know, and she's a great cat. So I get to the house, and I'm like, you know, it's good. I pet the cat. I get to know the cat. The cat's nice. The cat likes me. I'm cool. I'm cool. I wake up this morning. The cat has stolen my teeth. I take the bridge, which is my only shot at mastication on any level, without eating like a rodent, right? And the glass is tipped over in the sink. It's empty. It's gone. And now I yell at the cat, what did you do with my teeth? And I realize I'm crazy. And I'm about to say, no. Where? Where's the teeth? And then I'm like thinking, well, I'll call my buddy. He's in New York, L.A., but I'll call him. Where, you know, where's the cat's favorite places? Where did she stash stuff, you know? I'm going. Now, also, here's the deal. I have an eating disorder. And part of my eating disorder is I have to, like, you know, eat so that I don't outgrow a pair of shower curtains. At any rate, so then, then I think, okay, all right, okay, cool. I can't really eat a lot. So somehow the cat is stashed the teeth so I can't eat and I'm going to be released from this obsession. And I'm like, it's 8 o'clock, right? It's 8 o'clock. I've covered all this material. It's 8 o'clock. And I'm cool. I realize I'm fine. I'll take advantage of this opportunity. You know, to eat in a sensible way, or at least, you know, a little lower down on the food chain. And then I find the teeth, which the cat has put in an unspeakable place. Unspeakable place. The kind of place where you really want to take it to a breeder reactor and just dunk it into the reactor, you know, for a couple of minutes. But it's all I got, folks. I ain't got anything else. And what does it have to do with, if you're new, what does it have to do with sobriety? Absolutely nothing unless you're going through it. Absolutely nothing. Because at the end of the day, I was fine. I don't have to write any inventory. I got to really laugh at myself. And I think the cat is terrified of me at this point because I kept asking her where the teeth are. I was at a meeting a couple of weeks ago, and I heard can I see the hands of people in their first year? Wow. Welcome to AA. I'm so, so pleased that you're here. I really am. I'm really, really glad that you're here. And in LA, we ask, and you know, I'm sure you have a lot of meetings where you do this, where they do it all over the place. They ask for people with less than 30 days to raise their hand and say their name and the nature of their illness. And at this particular meeting, I heard a newcomer identify in a way that was the single best identification for a newcomer I've ever heard. And I collect these things. I've heard people share that, you know, identify as crack monsters and dope fiends and, you know, just also. But this guy got up. People are going, you know, my name's Carmen. I'm an alcoholic. My name's Joe. I'm an alcoholic. This guy got up and he said, my name's Tom. Big problem. And I swear we all could have gone home. I mean, we all could have gone home. It was the whole deal. I believed him, number one. I believed him. Big problem. Because I want to tell you, that was my identification when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I couldn't say I was an alcoholic. I didn't know what an alcoholic was. But big problem. Big, big problem. I love coming back east. I grew up in the Bronx. I lived in New York my whole life. It's wonderful for me to come home. It's really funny. When I was a kid, I grew up in a Jewish family, and in my neighborhood there were a bunch of gangs, and I got my ass kicked a lot for being Jewish. And if you were a Jewish kid, you didn't go near St. Margaret's because you just got your ass kicked if you went near St. Margaret's. So I'm a year sober. I come back to New York for the first time sober. Had been living in L.A. for a while. I call AA. Where's the AA meeting? St. Margaret's. So I got to go into St. Margaret's. I can't believe I got to go into St. Margaret's. And I've heard in L.A., I've heard about all this tough AA in New York. It's tough. It's tough. It's different. It's tough AA in New York. So I walk into St. Margaret's, and I can't believe I'm here. And I hear singing, and I go, oh, no, they sing the 12 steps. You know, I'm screwed. So I follow the singing. I come up in the middle of the sacristy. There's a, you know, a service going on, and the priest sees me in the back of the room. He goes, so I go into the AA meeting. This is not a tough AA meeting. It's an AA meeting. It was a beautiful AA meeting. And I see this guy who looked kind of familiar to me. I walk up to him. And I said, you know, I grew up in this neighborhood. You kind of like, you look familiar to me. And he said, I don't live in this fag neighborhood. I live in Parkchester, where they tell you to do the right goddamn thing. Sorry. I guess I found it. But I've been to Alcoholics Anonymous all over the world. I've been to Alcoholics meetings in over 40 states. I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous in Asia. And I want to tell you, Alcoholics Anonymous is the same everywhere I go. Now, you might think that's strange or even unbelievable, but the basic message of Alcoholics Anonymous, which is pure love, the basic message of Alcoholics Anonymous, which is if I don't have some sort of spiritual experience, I'm going to die, I have found that at every meeting that I've gone to, even if it's just a big book laying on a podium, you know? And I love it because there was no help for me. I grew up in the Bronx to a completely insane family. My wife never believed me about my family until she met him. And my mom threw an engagement party for us, and my Aunt Rose came to the party and wore her wig backwards. And it had a bun on it. So the bun was bouncing off her forehead the whole night. I had not exaggerated the situation. I had understated the situation. My wife walked around this room as if she had been hit by a wrecking ball. I mean, it was because this was all bad news. Because this is the genetic pool that she was. If you got anything for free, I mean, it was stolen in my family. I had an uncle who was a welder who used to get free bales of steel wool. What is that? That. Here's your check and your complimentary bale of steel wool. And his wife took a decorating course and made throw pillows and filled all the throw pillows with the free steel wool. And that stuff works its way through on you after a while. So that when you were at their house, if you looked at the room, everybody was moving a little bit. You know, the whole room was like a living, breathing, pulsing organism. And and there was and it was bad. It was really bad. There was chronic institutionalization and suicide attempts. And I had relatives in the back wards of Grassland State Mental Institution. There was mental and physical abuse. It was terrible. And if you knew, all I've got is good news for you, because my family didn't have anything to do with making me an alcoholic. I'm not telling you that I wasn't injured. I was severely injured by my family, and I'm not telling you that I didn't have to do stuff about that. I did stuff about that. I continue to do stuff about that. I am telling you they didn't make me a drunk. I can't stop drinking once I start. And if you're a drug addict and special, welcome. Try some controlled crack smoking. You know, just fill your mouth up with crack smoke and say, I'm not in the mood, and blow it out. And hats will fill the air. Gotcha. I can't moderate. I have. If you're new, it's really weird. There's a class of people, of allergic people, that can't control. They can't moderate once they begin. And when it's coupled with, it's referred to as alcoholic thinking at Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. It's the source of a lot of mirth at AA meetings. It's this bizarre thinking that, you see, I've got this allergy, and I can't stop drinking once I start. And I've got this thinking that says, you don't have an allergy. Don't have an allergy. You don't. And once I continued to take a drink that I couldn't stop taking, I developed this this soul sickness, this spiritual tapeworm, which is actually the architecture of alcoholism. It's the fifth wheel. It's this bizarre element that plucked me beyond the opportunity to be helped by well-meaning clergy members of the medical profession, good doctors, good psychiatrists, loving parents, a loving family, a loving wife, children who love me, a great career. None of that stuff could penetrate this phenomenon. And I still have the spiritual sickness. I have to treat it, and I still have this wacky thinking. I still have it. I'm 19 and a half years in. I still have it. I was sharing with two of my friends how I still have the thinking. I was about 14 years sober. I had to get surgery on my hand. And this doctor said to me, you know, Mr. Edmund, you're going to need general anesthetic with this surgery. And I said, oh, general anesthetic. That's great. Normal people don't get excited about general anesthetic. There's no normal person that goes, general anesthetic? And I'll tell you why. First of all, you're unconscious for general anesthetic. You are generally anesthetized. The other deal is that, you see, you know what I leave out? I leave out the surgery. I leave that out completely. I just go, this is what I go to. Because I know something about general anesthetic. I know that when they hit you with it, they say count backwards from 100. And you go, 100, 99. I love 99. I love 99. I love it. But that, in a normal person, that doesn't eclipse the operation experience, which is like they cut you open, there's bleeding, pain, there's a recovery. It's a wound. They're actually wounding you. So a couple of years later, I have a different doctor, and he said, you know, that surgery you had on the left hand, you need it on your right hand, same surgery. I said, wow. I guess we'll be having some of that general anesthetic. And this doctor looked at me and said, you don't need general anesthetic with that. And my first thought was, no, I need another goddamn doctor. That's what I need. Quick. I didn't have alcoholism when I came to AA. If you're new here and you don't have alcoholism, all I want to do is urge you to stick around long enough to get a diagnosis, because I'm telling you, it took me a long time to find out what alcoholism was and that I had it. And I had no alcoholism when I got here. I developed a mild case at first. The infection enters through the ear, and then you get it bad. And now I have a fatal case of it. It's gotten really worse. But I was an alcoholic for a lot of reasons. Number one, I'm Jewish. Jews don't drink, you know, because it might dull the pain. And you don't want that thing. You don't want to... You don't want to squander any agony opportunities. You know, it's really funny. One of the first guys that gave me the message of AA when I got here was the guy at my first home group. He said, I'm an ex-Catholic, which means that I don't believe in God, and I'm therefore positive God is going to come kill my ass for feeling that way. And I said, oh, I'm going to sit near him, because I completely understand. I had been introduced to an Old Testament God I wouldn't be caught in a dark alley with, you know. And in addition to the Judaism, I couldn't have been an alcoholic, because I had been in psychotherapy for 18 years. I was going to be dead, but I was going to understand it. And I'm not indicting or putting down therapy on any level. I have used therapy a bunch of times in sobriety. I'm in therapy now. I don't treat my alcoholism with psychotherapy. I also don't have any outside help. I go to therapy because of the 10-step work I've done in Alcoholics Anonymous. None of this stuff is outside help to me. It's all because of AA, not instead of AA. If I do any of it instead of AA, I'm doomed. And I was going to therapy to treat my alcoholism, which is like going to a gunfight with a knife once a week. Showing up with that, I got the knife again. I used to hear this story I used to love when I was new in AA. I haven't heard it in a long time, actually. I used to tell this in my home group. If three people walk through a door, a psychotic, a normal person, and an alcoholic, all walk through a door, and they got smashed in the face with a 2x4, the psychotic would walk through a couple of more times, get smashed each time, and then stop. The normal person would walk through once, get hit, and never do it again. The alcoholic would walk through every day, get smashed in the face with a 2x4, and if one day he walked through and didn't get hit, he'd go, I can wait. The guy probably had to get coffee. Maybe he's on a piss break. He'll come back, smash me, and then I can go on. And unfortunately, I identified with that. I went, whoa. Man. At any rate, the idea of most therapy, most conventional therapy, is to uncover, discover, and unravel, to free associate. In Freudian therapy, it's to free associate, delve into your past. And if you're neurotic, if you're not pathological or psychotic, but just a neurotic, if you have neurosis, what a neurosis is commonly understood as is that you have anxiety. And then you resolve the anxiety. You come up with a way to resolve the anxiety, which is not good. It's not good. It creates more anxiety. So I don't know if this resonates for anybody here. Your solutions are worse than your problems. I don't know. So I'm going to therapy, and I go to therapy. I say, look, I feel terrible. Why? Well, I was so drunk yesterday. I was too drunk to walk, so I drove. Well, what are we going to do about that? Let's talk about it. Hey, I got an idea. What were you thinking just before you did it? Nothing. Nothing. I feel terrible. Why? Well, yesterday I sharpened a hypodermic needle on the back of a matchbook striker and sucked some heroin up through a fluffed up cigarette filter and injected it. I just feel miserable. What were you thinking just before you did it? Nothing. My brain got too big for my skull. My mouth filled with saliva. The room spun. I went out for cigarettes. I was in Baltimore. I don't know. I don't know what to tell you. I live near a rabbit hole. Every time I walk out of my house, I fall down the rabbit hole. I don't know. Treat that. Treat nothing. Nothing. I don't know. And it says it in our book. If you pursue a drunk and ask them why, why in heaven's name do you drink despite the misery and suffering that follows every time you do it? If they stick with you, odds are they have no more idea than you. It's bone chilling. I love the readings at the beginning of the meeting tonight. I love that paragraph. Driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, self-pity. Driven isn't nudged or influenced. Driven implies in slavery to, under the lash of. And I didn't know. I didn't know I had alcoholism. But it's just not fair. It's not fair to ask a therapist to treat alcoholism. You'd need a board of therapists. My alcoholism is so efficient in terms of generating insanity and difficulty and anxiety. You need a panel of therapists 24 hours a day, 7 days a week to file my crap, just to get it into a folder and put it on in a file, for God's sake. At any rate, I did not want to be an alcoholic. I overcame my alcohol problem with marijuana. I'd like to welcome all the pot smokers. You remember WOW, right? WOW. And right after WOW usually came, What? Watching a pot smoker is like watching a dog try to run on linoleum. There's like a lot of activity, but no movement. They just can't get a claw in the rug. And I overcame my marijuana problem with pills. And I conquered pills with cocaine. Cocaine is an excellent drug. It's particularly good for sex if you enjoy sex from the Neolithic period. And I kicked that gold on cocaine with heroin. Heroin's a very dark, complicated, artistic drug. And you cross a line and become a vomiting pig. And I drank. And I don't mean to offend. I know some people don't like to hear about drugs in AA. And if you talk to them, they asked me to come talk. I didn't call them up and say, can I come to New Jersey? Seriously. If you thank me at the end of the meeting, don't straighten me out. I don't mean to offend anybody, but these guys have heard my tape. It's not like, whoa, what the hell's he doing? I have a friend named Carl. I love him so much. Because in my area, in a couple places, they don't like you to talk about drugs. And he says, isn't it incredible? We come to AA. Guy gets up to the podium and says, I've been to jail. I've been sodomized for 4 years. Now, I'm sorry, but I'm going to talk about drugs. At any rate. I dropped out of school when I was 14. I tried to join a gang. At that time, I was being brought into this gang, this circle of guys around me by this guy, George. And he said, look, we steal Chevy Biscaynes and Fairlanes, all right? The ignition's on the column. It's gone off, on, and lock. So if it's on lock, shine the car, get another car. If it's on, off, put your key in the car, turn it on, cruise. And I looked around and said, what if it's on? He said, then someone's in the car, you moron. So I failed Gang 101, but the hippies had a recruiting station right across the street. And there was no paperwork and no test. And it was a lot of fun. If you're new, you're going to hear a lot of wacky stuff about alcoholism now that you're here. And I want to tell you, some of it makes a lot of sense to me and some of it doesn't. The stuff that doesn't make sense to me, I've never found in the Big Book of AA. None of it I ever have. And yet some of these things make sense to people in Alcoholics Anonymous, which is fine. I've heard that alcoholics don't like change. I don't like change I don't like. But I really like change that I like. I've never heard anyone at a meeting get up and say, geez, I hit the lottery, I'm having sex with identical twins, it's killing me. Change is ripping me apart. I've heard that alcoholics are perfectionists. I'm a pig. I am not a perfectionist. The only time that I have an explosion of perfectionism is when my wife is caring for me. Then I get a lot of perfectionism. My favorite, though, is I've heard that alcoholics are above average intelligence. I have only heard this at Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. I have never heard it anywhere else. I have never heard it at an Al-Anon meeting, ever. Ever. He woke up in the middle of the night and peed in the closet. He's a genius. A genius. I know a guy in AA who fell into his closet drunk. His wife's bearskin coat fell on him, and he fought it for 3 hours. And when he got out, he said, honey, you better call those people. True story. True story. Genius. One of the most misquoted and maligned sentences in the Big Book of AA, I've heard people in the Alcoholics Anonymous meetings say, my worst day sober is better than my best day out there. No. No. I had a great time out there until I died. You know? I had a great time. Well, let's see. A pound of cocaine, an all-female jazz band, or a panel at the prison. I don't know. What do you want to do? I had such a good time until I died, you know? What the line says at the end of chapter 3, what the guy says is, I wouldn't trade my worst day in here for my best day out there, because I won't trade this way of life. I won't settle for a nickel today when I could have a quarter tomorrow. I won't live like a sap anymore. I won't live for 99. I won't trade my life in for 99. I get that. I understand that. You know. And what we're suggesting that you do here, if you're new, is when you want to drink, don't. The not drinking part's a moose. If it was not for the not drinking part, we would be a much bigger organization. I guarantee it. I absolutely guarantee it. The not drinking part sucks for people who don't want to not drink. But so I grew up in this crazy family, and I started therapy at 14, and the fact is that, you know, no matter how hurtful my family was, they can't give me this allergy. They can't give me a spiritual sickness. They could give me some pretty serious psychological problems, which, if you ask the cat I'm living with right now, I seem to have. I was 21 years old. I was in a cycle of using intravenous drugs at that time, and I was hitchhiking down from the Bronx down the West Side Highway to Manhattan, and my aunt and uncle, this is the 60s, and my aunt and uncle pulled up on the highway. My father had a massive stroke, and they put me in the back of the car, and drove me to the hospital, and I couldn't show up for my old man the night that he died. And I just couldn't believe it. I had holes in my arms. The curtain was down. I couldn't even go into the room and touch my pop on the cheek and tell him I love him, give him a kiss, and watch him take his light into another room. It was unfathomable to me that I had turned into such an animal, that I had so completely collapsed as a man, as a son. I couldn't be there for my mother or my brother. And it was one of those frozen moments, one of those naked lunch moments where I was just caught staring at the end of my fork going, wow, you know. And I had to do some really fast work. And I did. And I figured out really quick that the problem was heroin and needles. That's what had happened to me. And all I had to do was never put a needle in my arm again, and I wouldn't be the guy who couldn't show up for his old man. And that's what I did. I never put a needle in my arm again until I did. Not for 13 years. Shortly after that, by the time I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I reached or surpassed just about every dream I had ever had. And shortly after my dad died, I was acting in a Broadway play, and a new usherette with long brown hair walked into that theater. I was about 22. And I took one look at her, and I didn't say hello to her. I walked back into the dressing room of this show and stood up on a chair and announced to the male members of this company that if anyone talked to the new usherette with long brown hair, I'd break all the bones in their hands and feet. And we've been married 28 years at this point. Because, in part, because we've never wanted to get divorced at the same time. And anyone who's been married for any length of time knows exactly what I'm talking about. There's a lot of timing involved here, folks. A lot of timing. And we had a great time. We were in our early 20s. I was acting on Broadway. We were living in Manhattan. We had a great time. And Nancy started getting troubled from prolonged exposure to me. She started getting sick, and we got so sick that at one point a guy lent us his car and we sold his car. I will never forget this guy's voice on the phone as long as I live. He said, "You sold my car? That's like house sitting for someone, and they come out and you're in escrow, you know?" Because the alcoholic life becomes the only normal one. We didn't have any money for rent. No, really. And I looked into my wife's eyes and I said, "I am so sick of being a punk, irresponsible kid. Let's do the right thing. Let's not borrow money. Let's stand up on our own 2 feet. Let's sell the car." And my wife looked at me with tears in her eyes and said, "Let's do." Now, I understand how that happens. It's just, look, that's the same reason I love general anesthetic. That's why I love dental surgery. Normal people don't love dental surgery. I love dental surgery because it's triple script time, you know? But here's the deal. Why do I love dental surgery? Because I leave out the surgery. I just go, "You're having dental surgery? Painkillers." I leave out the sutures, the blood, all of that stuff. I go to, "Let's do the right thing, pay the rent," and I leave out Grand Theft Auto. I leave the whole thing out. I don't know. It's magical thinking. I leave out forging the pink slip, looking behind me in the mirror for 4 years. You know, I leave out. At any rate, one of the defects of character that has plagued me in and out of sobriety, one of the most injurious ones to me, and it's actually, I have a lot of recovery with it, but it still is injurious to me, is the defect of mind reading. I think that I know what people are thinking at times. And I want to tell you, they're never thinking anything good. They're never thinking, "Hey, he's pimpy." They're thinking, "You're an ignorant slob." I mean, they're thinking, "That's mine." They're thinking, they're never, really. My wife once said to me, because it's hard living with a mind reader because they complete your sentences, you know, the whole thing, you know. She said, "You're not a mind reader. You're barely a mind user." Which that hurt my feelings. It was very cold. My wife in her Al-Anon family, and I know that a lot of people do this everywhere, but she's done it in her Al-Anon family for years. her sponsor said, "When you know when you think when you're in a couple and things start moving quick, especially in the car, things can start moving quick. Especially when my wife puts her foot on the imaginary brake when she's in the passenger seat, and things started moving quick, you know." And my wife, and what she was taught in her Al-Anon group was to say, "You know, sweetheart, you could be right. You could be right." So things started moving pretty quick in the car. And my wife said, we were pretty new. She said, "You know, honey, you could be right, but not today." She went, you know what? She went there and then it just, she crumbled. But she did better next time. It's not your day, big guy. We had our son Micah. He was really welcomed into the world. We were surrounded by friends and family and got a ton of phone calls. We've been married a couple of years. And 2 years and 9 months later, when our son Jesse was born, there were no phone calls, no flowers. We had become completely isolated by the disease of alcoholism. No one even came to the hospital to wish us well. And it wasn't because people didn't love us. A lot of people loved us. It hurt too much to be around us. We pressed ourselves on the people that loved us like a thumb upon a bruise. It was too hard. It was too scary. And Jesse was sick. He went up to neonatal intensive care. And I got a call that night from the doctor, and she said, "Where are you?" It's a doctor I'd never met before, a big hospital in L.A. We were living in L.A. by that time. "Your wife's in extreme psychological duress. Your baby is sick. What is going on?" And I said, "You know what? I can't find anybody to watch my two-year-old kid. I can't." And this doctor I'd never met before said to me something remarkable. She said, "My husband's home. I'll give you my address. You can take your kid to my house. My husband will take care of him." And I said no. I had no way to accept this woman's generosity. My kid would have been better off if I had taken him to the waiting room and left him alone with a coloring book. At least he could have got the hell away from me for a while. Instead, he was trapped with this insane man racked with guilt, making it all about me one more time. Because it was all about me. It was all about me. My disease was there. It was in plain sight. It was huge. You know, the ice around our heart had become so thick. Our lives had become so pathetic and so tiny. And I didn't even know we had alcoholism. I didn't know it. I hadn't read our literature. I hadn't read about the warped lives of blameless wives and children. I hadn't read the lists in chapters 2 and 3. I hadn't read about the stuff that gets hardwired into the minds of our friends and family and us. What's the use anyhow? My kids lived in a horrible world where they were locked into either pursuing dreams that were impossible to reach because stuff just didn't work out, or they became pointless and they threw in the towel over and over again, or they became pointlessly aggressive en route to stuff that was never attainable. They were either crazy and aggressive or passive and detached. And that's what happened in my alcoholic home. And I had no idea it was alcoholism. And then things got bad. Things got really bad. I mean, that was a horrible moment in our life. And it went on for 3 years. 3 years. I'll tell you what a good day in the Redmond home was before I got sober. My son came to me, this is before I tell you that, I also want to tell you that when my older son was 5, he came to me and asked me if there was anything such as God, and I looked into the eyes of my perfect, beautiful 5-year-old son, and I said no. I didn't want him to be played like a sap or a sucker. I didn't want him to be... I wanted him to have the real existential deal, something every 5-year-old hungers for. And I lied to him. I thought I was giving him the real stuff. And what I was giving him, and if you're new, please read our 4th chapter because it speaks to this more beautifully and eloquently than I'll ever be able to. What I was giving him was actually the most pathetic, mushiest, weakest thinking I possibly could. I was, in fact, standing in the presence of all this immutable law, all of this harmony, and saying that it was a pointless cipher wandering nowhere. That's an insane idea. It's an insane idea. The fact is no one can fully comprehend or define that power, which is God. At least I could have said, I don't know. But I didn't. So what I told a 5-year-old boy was basically, you know when you're scared and you can't go to sleep? Tough, because that's all there is. That's what I said to this baby. He should have been taken away from me. And good day in the Redmond home. A couple of months before I got sober, I got into an accident and I was taken to the hospital. And My blood pressure was about 180 over 110. So they said, look, you're about to stroke out. You got to bring your blood pressure down. You got to lose weight. I said, look, I would like to lose weight, but I drink alcohol and smoke marijuana before I go to bed every night, so I'm not going to be able to. And the doctor said, why don't we prescribe some medication for you? And I said, what a country. And he prescribed for me chloral hydrate to get past this going to sleep problem. Chloral hydrate is a Mickey. It's like getting hit in the head with a sap. It's a fast-acting sedative, and it's a knockout drop. And I love these pills. I love these knockout drops. So Nancy comes home, and I'm standing in the hallway, eating handfuls of knockout drops, slamming my arms into the wall to keep myself awake to enjoy my knockout drop. Because you don't want to waste a perfectly good knockout drop. So I'm eating handfuls of drugs, smashing body parts into the wall until I seize. I keel over, and I get up to bed, and now I'm incontinent like the rest of the 33-year-old men in America. By the way, I think adult diapers would have kept me out there years more. I'm glad that Depends didn't hit the market until I got sober. But and so I'm incontinent, but it's part of my condition. And one night I got up and wet the wall. And Nancy was excited, you know. She made me a big... He's headed towards the bathroom. It's progress, not perfection. We got movement here. So that was a good morning in the Redmond home. On April 22nd, 1985, with my career done, my children were 6 and 3. They were... their small motor skills were screwed up. They couldn't complete small tasks. They were reading and writing years below their grade level. They were making clicking sounds with their throat that they couldn't stop making. They couldn't stop grinding their teeth. They would cry. They cried a lot. And there was nothing organically wrong with them. And I didn't know that they were ravaged by alcoholism. My wife and I were done. My career was done. I mean, my kids couldn't complete small tasks. Their small motor skills were disrupted from being scared all the time. And on April 22nd, 1985, I crossed the line. I swore I would never cross again. I put a needle in my arm. And why I didn't make it okay to put a needle in my arm, I don't know. God knows I'd drawn enough lines in the sand, and then when I did it, I'd make it okay. Why I didn't make it okay that morning, I couldn't. It's a complete mystery to me, an utter mystery to me. I called my therapist in my 18th year of psychotherapy, my first Jungian therapist, and I didn't know this at the time, but when I called him and I told him what I had done, and he said to me that morning the exact same thing that Carl Jung, and if you're new and you read our history, you'll see this stuff's in there. It's really quite remarkable. Carl Jung, the therapist, said the exact same thing this guy said to me, to the guy who 12-stepped Bill Wilson. He was an American millionaire whose parents had the wherewithal. He was a dying alcoholic. They sent him to be analyzed by one of the fathers of modern psychology. He was analyzed by him, and he drank. And Jung, when he came back to Jung, Jung said to this guy what this guy said to me. He said, you know what? I can't help you. There's nothing that can be done for you. And I said, what? And he said, we either have to institutionalize you, which is what Jung said to this guy. You either have to get a bodyguard or we have to lock you up. And then he said to me the thing that Jung couldn't say to Roland Hazard. He said, or you attend a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous or Narcotics Anonymous. Now, why I went to that meeting, I don't know. It's a mystery to me. It's a mystery I used to be uncomfortable with that I'm very comfortable with today. It's the beautiful mystery. To know God is to not know God. And I, through some friends, I found an AA meeting, a 7 a.m. AA meeting. I got my best clothes on. I brought a check to write you. I had no idea. No idea. I went to this meeting at a place called Unit A in the San Fernando Valley in L.A. I walked into this meeting, and I took one look around, and I said, oh, my God, how did I wind up in Alcoholics Anonymous? Alcoholics Anonymous. And the room looked like it was the product of 200 years of inbreeding to me. I mean, it was just unbelievable. There were like identical twins carving their initials on each other's feet in the back of the room. I mean, that's the way it seemed to me, you know. And everything was a miracle. I'm a miracle. You're a miracle. The coffee's a miracle. And I'm waiting for the Jew hunt to start, right? And I know that's going to break out any minute. Come on, Jaime, strap these antlers on. Always wanted to run a big buck Jew. Come on, it'll be fun. We'll knock his beanie off. When he bends over to pick it up, we'll push him over. It'll be fun. Man, oh man, oh man. Then the AA unsolicited information guy, he saw me after the meeting. You know him, right? He's got a belt buckle large enough to serve an entire fish on. Do I want what you've got? No. No. No, but thanks for spitting on me, Clyde. I appreciate it. I'll come back next week. We'll hook a rug, okay? It'll be great. Do I bring my own bib overalls? Am I issued a pair? This was the worst thing. I mean, I felt my DNA unraveling. This was the worst thing that had ever happened to me. I went to that meeting every morning for a year. And I think I know why I did. I don't think this is so much of a mystery. Part of this is not so much of a mystery. I was out of plans. I was out of plans. If you're new here, I pray for you that you are out of plans. If you have a plan, it's probably a butte. Don't use your plan. Grab one of us after the meeting and tell us your plan. We want to know the plan. My favorite newcomer plan, and I believe that it's going to wind up on the soft literature rack eventually, is the... is the one more dope deal to set myself up financially for sobriety plan. It's a big 10-4 on that one. And my wife reached out to the Al-Anon family groups, and I don't need her to be an Al-Anon, but I sure love the fact that she is, because we're walking a path. And she hooked up with the sponsor named Ruby, who's her sponsor today, who I love. And we were so damaged. We were so injured. My kids were such a wreck. My marriage, I had nothing to bring to my marriage. Nothing. I didn't know how to fight. I didn't know how to talk to my wife. I didn't know how to clean up after myself. I didn't know how to act like a grown man. My whole life, I'm standing next to guys 10 years younger than me, and I'm thinking, what's it like to be grown up? It's a crappy way to live. You're a dollar short and a day late every day. I don't know how to fight. I either scream at my wife until she shuts up, or I cry until she shuts up. One of the two. I love the tyranny of helplessness. I've always enjoyed it. And I'm loomer. I'm a loomer. I'm big. I'm a loomer. I like to loom, get a light behind me and like get her in the shadow, you know, when I'm looming. I like it. It's like total eclipse of the Jew if I get her like right in there, right? And if I can work like a scream, a cry, and a loom into one fight, that's a hat trick. It doesn't get much better than that. I'll give you the Scott Redmond couples workshop right now. Takes 11 seconds. Talk to her until she changes her mind. That's all. Just keep talking until her eyes roll back in her head and she keels over. And on the way over, she goes, oh, okay. And that's it. That's what I'm bringing. That's what I'm bringing. I'm bringing nothing. I don't clean up after myself. I feel like a 10-year-old kid. I think somewhere in the back of my twisted brain that a certain amount of housework should equal a certain amount of sex. That there should be like conversion tables on the back of cleaning products of housework to sex. Right? So I'm cleaning the house and I say to my wife, I'm finished, honey. And she's saying, more than you'll ever know. Oh my God. You guys said don't get involved in your first year. We didn't. We had these insane rules in our house. I mean, our kids were not allowed to eat sugar, watch TV, or curse. So my wife's giving them granola for breakfast and putting them in the car with me, Dr. Death, right? And saying, hope you live. You've had a hearty breakfast. Hope you make it. Because you can't, it's the elephant in the living room. You can't solve the problem, so you just fix the trimmings, you know. And My wife would take the boys over to Ruby's house, and Ruby would turn on the TV to the Love Boat, give them a big bowl of M&Ms, and curse. And the boys would just go, "Oh my God." I'm going to use one bad word. You'll forgive me, but you'll see why. Her husband, Milton, who was 10 years sober at the time, he's over 30 years sober now, called my sons over. They're little boys. And he called them over one day, and he bent down and he whispered to them, "Boys, your parents don't know shit." And they went, "Oh my God, we suspected, but now it's been confirmed. This is fantastic." And they love Ruby. Ruby's been giving them a $5 bill on their birthday just about their whole lives, you know, and they love Ruby. And you guys pried our jaws open and breathed life into a dead family. We were dead. We were done. And I was 6 months sober, and I knew I was going to drink because I had seen the AA drill hundreds of times. You know, I was receiving the gift of step none, which is, by the way, nothing. And and I was getting sicker, and I had seen the AA drill. Guys came in, gals came in, they did the work, they changed. They came in, they didn't do the work, they didn't change. They got sick, got sicker, got to the podium, shared their gift with us, and shared the rest right out of the door, or stayed here and became columns of human sewage and sexual predators, although I judge no men. Because I'm too spiritually developed. I'm so unjudgmental, I'm overwhelmed with it at times. It's an evaluation, not a judgment. And I asked a guy to sponsor me. He's a great guy. Still is a great guy. He invited me to his house. He made sure I'd done some reading from the big book of AA. I was 6 months sober. He brought me over to his house, and he read chapter 5 to me. And on the way through, he took me through the first two steps. We reached step 3 and got on our knees and said a prayer, which I felt was embarrassing and unnecessary, but I did it anyway. And he went back and after reading chapter 5 and gave me instructions on how to do a fourth step from the big book of AA. And I stopped feeling like I was stealing somebody's chair here. And in 9 months of sobriety, I read him my inventory. And I did step 6 and 7 for the first time, which have really become my centerpiece for my... It's where I draw close to God and he reveals himself to me. That's my flashpoint. That's where he whispers in my ear. And wrote up my 8-step list. I try to share this anytime I talk because it's simply the best reading of step 8 I've ever heard. And I heard it from a guy in my home group. I was a couple of weeks sober. I've never seen the guy before, and I've never seen him since. His name was Nino. This was in L.A. He had a heavy New York accent, and he had never read Chapter 5 before. He was reading it for the first time. And he was with a hospital group there. He had hospital plastic on. He was reading Chapter 5 for the first time. And he got up to Step 8, and he read, "Made a list of all those we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all." Jesus Christ! And he looked out into the room as if to say, "Have you seen it? Do you know what the hell is in here?" It was gorgeous. It was. If you're new, don't worry about it. It's 8 steps from where you are anyway, and 8's not the annoying one. It's 9 is really the annoying one. So I wrote up my 8-step list, and I didn't know what I was going to do about it. I didn't know what I was going to do about my dad or my wife or my kids or anything. And my sponsor, I was blessed with a sponsor who refused to tell me how to make amends. I'm not saying that's the right way to do it. It's the way he did it for me. I don't even know if that's the way he did it for other sponsees, but it's what he did for me. He said, "I don't know what," you know, I said, "I don't know what to do." He said, "Neither do I. Why don't you do your job in AA? Why don't you use your inventory as your spiritual task? Let's go. Let's go, man." And I started going. I started going on panels. Went up to the prison. Went up to Tehachapi Prison. And he went to minimum security, and I went to medium security. We met in the parking lot afterwards, and he was on fire. His eyes were on fire. I said, "How was it?" He said, "Well, it was incredible. I talked. You know, I even shared some of my homosexual experiences with the guys there in prison. It was amazing." He said, "How was it for you?" I said, "Well, it was incredible for me, too. I shared, and I even shared some of your homosexual experiences." And And he said, I'm so glad you've got your sense of humor back. And we just had I hit the floor running, and I started doing the stuff that you suggest that we do in AA. And I had to do some stuff that was embarrassing and upsetting, and I didn't want to do. I had to show up for my kids. I had to go to my kids' school where they were in big trouble and seen as real problems. And I had to sit down with teachers and say, my sons have been having a problem because they've been very ill, because they've been living with me and I've been very sick, and we're making a beginning. Can you help us? Everyone said yes. Everyone said yes. Everyone said, well, sure, we've got testing. Let's test the boys. Let's see what kind of resources we have. They tested them. They needed help. The teacher, special ed teacher, said, let's get them into a bigger motor stuff so that maybe it'll shake down and impact the small motor stuff. And Jesse wanted to, you know, get them into music, get them into sports. So we used some booze bucks to get them into the Little League, which I had never done. Get them, spend $10 to get them the right pair of jeans so that they don't feel weird on the schoolyard. I'm talking about a few dollars. I'm talking about being a citizen. Jesse wanted to play drums, so I didn't have any dough, so I bought him a drum pad. I went to the store. I said, what can you do with a kid want? And they said, get a book. It's a piece of wood with a piece of rubber and two sticks. I backed my kid up, and I gave it to him. He was, you know, pleased. And I went to my home group, and I told them about it. And if you got a home group like mine, which a lot of you do, and those who don't have a different kind of home group, I don't think my home group is the best one in AA. I think it's one of the ones in AA. I told the guys what I'd done. And I'll tell you why. Because they were interested in my family. They were rooting for us. And within 2 months, the AA drum set showed up at our house. There were a lot of burnout drummers in my group at that time. And these guys are showing up with these Megadeth drums, you know, dude. And Jesse had a drum set that was so big that he literally disappeared behind it. You couldn't see him. And a couple of years ago, my sons played the House of Blues on the L.A. Strip. Ooh, a packed house, man. They walked out on that stage, both of them, these two gorgeous, handsome men, and burnt the dump down. 800, 900 kids, elbow to elbow, playing hip-hop music, and killed them. And off to the side, there's this group of weeping middle-aged alcoholics. You know, the kids are kind of going, what is with the crying old people? What is that? What exactly is that groove? That's their AA and Alan on aunts and uncles that have been following them around for the last 19 years. Yeah. My family got, I'm sure you heard about it, a couple of years ago, the Northridge earthquake hit L.A., and we got really badly injured. My house was kind of in the middle of the epicenter. I got a bad physical injury, and a guy died right near us, and the house got smashed up. It was really bad. And shortly after, we were at an AA function out of town. And this woman who used to live in L.A. came up to me at the function. It was actually in Canada. And she said to me, oh, God, I'm so glad that God got us out of L.A. before the quake. And I said, oh, so he likes you. He likes you. But we're crap. But he likes you. And she said to me, well, I guess he just felt you had some lessons to learn. I'm out of here. I can't live in that world for 15 minutes. I can't possibly live in a world where I've got a God saying, get him. Get the Redmond boy. Get him. Get him. No evacuation plan for you, Jew boy. Get him. Get him. Turn his wife to salt. Kill his goat. Put a finger in his eye. Get him. Get him. Smote his ass. Smote him. Smote anyone he talks to. Smote them all. Get out the old jawbone. I can't live in that world. I can't live in that world. St. Thomas says to know God is to not know God. The big book of AA says that no one can fully comprehend that or define that power which is God. Every time I ascribe an intention or a personality to God, I cut my make my God this tiny little thing. And I've done that in AA. I've identified people in AA and groups in AA as the source of the power. On our best day, we can reflect. We can reflect it. Keep ourselves clean enough so the lens is clean enough to reflect some of it. But the source of it, I don't understand. It's a mystery to me. The thing I know is that my God expects me to do my job in AA, whether it's to show a guy how to stay sober through, you know, my kids who are functionally retarded. One of them wound up at the University of Chicago on a full scholarship on physics. You know, the other one, I mean, what my kids have accomplished is remarkable, but I can't possibly live in a world because my God likes me more than the parents of kids who are being annihilated. I can't live with a God that's going, well, let's key your car. You're due for a rash, don't you think? It's boils for you. It's insane. It's a that's a petty world. To me, that's a petty world. When I was reading my inventory, I had a lot of stuff about Nazis and Nazi Germany and the slaughter of Jews on it. I was very scared of this as a kid. I was shown these terrible, terrible films of concentration camps in religious school. I had a lot of nightmares about it, and there was a lot of material about it on my inventory. And I read, I'm resentful at Nazis for slaughtering Jews during World War II. It affects my self-esteem, pocketbook, ambition, and sex. What are the defects of character in me that if God would have removed the resentment would be gone? Resentment's no big deal. It's just the source of all spiritual illness. The great destroyer of all alcoholics. It'll drag your ass out, cut you off from the sunlight of the spirit and kill you. But don't be alarmed. Work a step a year. Relax. Because I don't just hate. I hate so that when I wake up, I water the hatred like a little flower. I care for it. I want to make sure it's robust and growing and developing. I hate so that when my head hits the pillow, it becomes a rotisserie. You know? It eats my brain and eats my heart and turns my life black. Because I re-experience this over and over again. So, what am I going to do? What am I going to do? If you're new here, I want to share with you what used to be my favorite sentence in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it could be your favorite sentence, too. I used to read it every night before I went to bed. They're assuming that you've written a list of the people who have screwed you. The resentments, the stuff that I just talked about. And they're assuming that you've written a list, and you're looking at the list. You're looking at the list. Oh, this is so great. It starts on 65 and continues on 66. If you're looking at the list, it says, the first thing apparent was that its world and its people were often quite wrong. Well, that's enough for tonight. I don't really think we need to go much further than that. Don't read the next two pages. And I'll tell you why. Because what it says the beautiful thing that our book says over and over again. It says, never fight with a drunk. It says, you're right. They've screwed you. They've screwed you, screwed you. They have mistreated you. They've abused you. You're right. And you're dead. You're dead. Because you experience this wrongdoing in a way that is so injurious and so disturbing that if you don't get free of it, you're going to die. And you don't have to say that they were right. I'm resentful at Nazis. What are the defects in me that if God would remove the resentment would be gone? Let's try nothing. My sponsor said, what do you mean? I said, what are you talking about? What in me? What are you talking about? What defects in me that if would remove the Nazi? I would. And he said, Scott, you don't understand the question. They're not asking you. They're not asking you if the event was your fault. They're asking you if the resentment is your fault. Was the event your fault? I said, no. He said, was the resentment your fault? Every time, with no exception and no loophole, every single time. What would a normal person do who didn't have a spiritual sickness, who was resentful against Nazis? Well, they would work against Nazis. They would give money to organizations that fight Nazis. They perhaps would do political work. They would live a good life. There's a million things they could do. And they probably would also not like Nazis. Okay? What do? I talk a lot of long crap, never leave the house, drink, and act like a schmuck. Okay? So what are the defects in me that if God would remove, I could act like a normal person who doesn't like Nazis and who works against them? Well, I'm filled with self-pity. Self-pity, if you bottled it, it would not crack off the market in a month. It's just better. It's better. It's more ready. It's there. I get a little lump in my throat. My tears fill up. I get a little slump. It's good dope. I'm filled with self-pity. I am not living in today. The worst thing is I'm a hypocrite because I hear someone has a German accent and I don't want to know who they are. It's horrible. I'm a racist. I'm an opportunist. I've used this as a weapon. I'm unforgiving. I'm not living in today. I'm irresponsible. And I got free. I got free. It was remarkable. I was resentful at my father for dying. What a terrible thing to admit, you know. And years later, when one of my guys I sponsor who are dying, and I held him as the last breath rattled out of me, and I felt you put my hand in my father's pocket in a way that was so incredible. And shortly after that, I didn't do that to make amends to my father. I did it because it's my job. And I realized that I couldn't talk about my father. I couldn't have a picture of him. It just hurt too much. And I realized my sons had no relationship with their grandfather because of my shame. And when this started getting relieved, I started getting relieved of this, I started telling my sons stories about their grandpa. I got this beautiful picture of him up on the mantle, you know. I was never going to be free of this stuff. It just wasn't going to happen. My God expects me to do my job in AA, whether it's to show somebody how to stay sober with robust kids who are enjoying themselves, or whether it's to show a guy how to stay sober through the annihilation of a child. My God's not. I got to do my job in AA. Humbly ask him to remove these shortcomings. Humbly isn't. Take him if you can, big guy. Humbly isn't. Take him, you rotten. Humbly is, Pop, I'm done. Can you please help me? Can you please? Please do my work. I'll do your work. I'd like to have a relationship with you. That's a real relationship. That's the flashpoint. That's the fire starting moment for Alcoholics Anonymous with me. What should I be doing instead? You know, and I said, I made a commitment, and I said in 6 and 7 that day with that 10th step, I said, I will do anything you want for a living. You can take show business, take it, it's yours. I'll do anything you want for a living. Anything that comes up, I will do it for a living. I'm done with show business. And within 2 months, I was working as a cook on a catering truck, and I looked up to God and I said, I did not mean this. I mean, I did. We've had a grotesque misunderstanding. This, like, wasn't even on the long list. I don't know. Look at the file again or something. This is bad. In LA, when they make a TV show or a movie, they hire a caterer, you follow the company around, you make food for them. It's a great job. It's Teamster dough. You're on a vehicle on a movie set. You make a lot of dough. But I'm Scott Redman. And the first movie that I cater, the star and executive producer of the movie was a guy who I had worked with in the industry. And he stuck his head on the truck that morning, and he said, can I have a burrito, Scott? And I said, what's happening, babe? And he said, is this your truck? I said, no, but it's my spatula. And I called my sponsor. I went home and I said, oh, we're getting a gift now. Oh, yeah, it's beautiful. And Don said to me, sounds like you've got a resentment. I'm resentful at Scott for working on the kitchen truck. It affects my self-esteem, pocketbook, ambition, personal relations, and sex. A five-bagger for sure. What are the defects of character in me that if God were to remove, the resentment would be gone? Blue skies. God's got a magic wand. He comes and touches me on the head. What is it in me that if it was gone, the resentment would be gone? Gone. I have false pride. I'm grandiose. I'm impatient. I'm greedy. I'm irresponsible. I'm a mind reader and a people pleaser. I'm ungrateful. I'm impatient. Ugh. And I worked the 10th step, and I read it to my sponsor, and I showed up and tried to give them a dime for their nickel, and I wound up serving people who had been my assistant stage managers on TV shows, serving actors who I had directed in shows, serving, and I'd come home to a new, like, back to my home group every week with a new tale of humiliation every week, and the guys would just go, tears streaming down their face. I had a guy on my inventory named Mark, and he used to kick my ass a lot when I was a little kid, under 5 years old. And this is in the Bronx. And the taper just told me I got 5 minutes left, which is going to be weird because that's not what I was after. So,
just went over
that. What? That's not what I was geared for, so, and I don't want to, like, finish up real quick. It wasn't a criticism. I just didn't know what to do. Okay. All right. And He was on my inventory. He really had humiliated me when I was a kid. He like embarrassed me at our first spin the bottle parties and stuff like that. So I didn't. I'm trying to give him a dime for the nickel. I'm trying to show up and do the right thing in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm starting to help people who felt that they had fallen from a height when they came to AA. They hadn't reached the top rank in AA, which is Child of God. I had a friend named Paul who used to say, "God, you know, God, I'm willing to do anything for a living. Just keep me sober, but don't let it be as bad as what you did to Scott." And the star of the sitcom that I didn't get the job with walks into my home group. And I look at the guy and go, oh, my God. So he hears me share a few times, and he pulls me aside. He says, I'd really like you to show me the work in the book. And I went, man, unbelievable. And I was clean. So I'm set up at home. He's coming over. He comes and he says, geez, I'm sorry I'm late, but our new director, my job, our new director is teaching an acting class, and he asked me to be a guest speaker. This guy, Mark. It's the kid who used to kick my ass. And now I'm going, get a hobby! Forget me! Forget my name! Rip up my phone number! I mean, it was just unbelievable! So I learned how to give them a dime for their nickel. I'm showing up. I'm doing my job. I'm doing the deal. And I cooked for about 3 years. And this company made an overture to me, this company, Ketchum Public Relations, for this big-time comedy writing job. And I really felt, I felt at this point, after suffering so much, that if I got this comedy writing job, man, what a great demonstration for the guys I sponsor. This would be, this would wow them. And I go mad. I mean, I had to do a videotape for these guys, but my brain blew up before I even found out about it. I just went cuckoo. And I wrote the inventory. I read it to my sponsor. I turned it over, and I was cool. And a couple of weeks later, I get a call from Ketchum. I didn't get the job, and I was fine. And then I get a call right after that from my catering company asking me to cater some commercials in the mountains above L.A. So I get up there with the truck, and I grab the call sheet, which is this sheet that gives you all the information about the shoot. And I see that the shoot is for Ketchum Public Relations. I'm feeding them now. I'm feeding them. I look at the end of the truck, and there's a guy videotaping me. He's taping my humiliation. So he's going to tape my humiliation. He's going to go back to New York with it, and they're going to say, is that Scott Redman with the meatloaf? This is terrible. So I call up my sponsor, and I said, oh, we're getting the gift now. Oh, yeah, it's beautiful. It's a miracle. It's just a miracle. Miracle, miracle. My sponsor says to me, I guess God had enough writers, and he needed a few cooks today. And then he said, you know, you told God that you wanted to work for Ketchum, and you forgot to tell him what you wanted to do. I got a lot of problems. I'm 19 and a half years sober, and I got a lot of problems. I got problems with eating. I got problems with money, with sex, with my marriage, with business. I got a lot of problems. I know there are people in AA who don't have problems. I'm so happy for them. I got a lot of problems, so I'm growing. I'm a seeker. If someone puts your finger in your chest and they say, that's the way AA is, if you're new, read the literature. Read the history. Alcoholics Anonymous was founded and developed by a bunch of acid-dropping, niacin-eating, Ouija-board-playing wackos. Seekers, famished for spiritual growth. People who decided to enlarge their spiritual life so that they would continue to grow and learn, because these problems sometimes continue. Sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly, but it'll always materialize if I work for them. If you're new, please take this thing as seriously as you possibly can and go out there and have the time of your life. Welcome to AA. Welcome home. Thanks for having me, folks.